I'm Ochip Dabney. Welcome.
Jake, good to be here.
I want to start by asking you to reflect on your former drummer, James Hunt.
James was a musical brother to me. We had a rhythm simpatico going that was just undeniable. You had to dance whenever the two of us would throw down the groove. The complexities of the Almosphere set list required the drummer to be able to go to New Orleans, to be able to go to Guadalajara, to be able to go to New York, house music, funk. You know, you've got to be able to bring it in a lot of different disciplines. And James, he had that background. So when we hooked up, it just started to fly.
He struck me as in the Almosphere, as a fusion drummer. But you're talking about Bayou? You're talking about New Orleans? I mean,
I'm talking about Willie Green, you know, Bayou.
Break it down.
I'm talking about Leo Nocentelli. I'm talking about James being able to play the music of James Brown and all those drummers that have gone through there, the Bernard Purdy's and what have you. I'm talking about James being able to play Little Feet music with us, you know. Mm. I mean, we play Paul Simon so James could go to South Africa with us. Our piano player, Tom Fetter, has a tune he wrote called Would You, Could You, which is a Latin tune that we whip out. You know, and you know, there's a certain style that you have to play it. I mean, it's not just the vertical thing that's going on. You know, when you add something to it, if you're going to cook the dish, you know, and it's a salsa or some kind, you're going to add a little something to it. It has to be right. So he had a knack for doing that.
Can you describe, as a musician, and you are a promoter, you have to be in this day and age, an advocate, how live improvisational music scene has changed in the last 40 years, specifically as it relates to audiences, okay? Audiences.
And live and improvisational music. What happened to improvisational music is that guys started just kind of going into their own worlds and not really having the communal conversation that made that unorchestrated music, music. Mm. If you don't make it music, it's noise. So noise doesn't have a really beneficial physiological effect on you. There is no visceral benefit to noise. So, you know, an effort needs to be made to bring that back, because to me, that's what the music really is about. I mean, if you're having conversations all your life and then you get together with some people who are of like mind, you don't need notes to be conversant. You know, you don't need to rehearse to have the dialogue because you're familiar with the subject matter. Mm-hmm. Musicians who play, you know, 12 to the bar, who, you know, improvise on certain kind of standard progressions and stuff, or know the 12-tone scale, should be able to just come together and have a beautiful dialogue. I think that really enriches the soul and the spirit and everything, the mind, the planet, you know, the people on other planets.
No, it's a universal. It's
Sun Ra thought they were on other planets, and right. So he was saying, hey, man, this music makes them feel good. I said, oh, that's deep.
A lot of people play blues scales. They say, let's play a blues tune.
Right.
Okay. You go back to Blind Lemon Jefferson, John Lee Hooker. You know, those guys were living the blues. So it's easy to play the blues. And I'm asking you this. To any musician out there, you've done a lot of work with R. Carlos Nakai in Native American music. And you bring your own individuality. You've done work with Aaron Neville, Gene Karn, Stephen Stills.
Cyril Neville.
So, but you go to New York, talk about how important it is. How much did you have to go inside the culture and the history to play the music?
Well, an example, and I wasn't able to do this in all cases. In the early 80s, I think around 1983, master musician, saxophonist O.J. Ekwemode had a group called the Nigerian All-Stars. And I moved in to the band house and ate, you know, Nigerian food, moi moi, and this, and learned how to cook stews and stuff like that, and, you know, picked up a little, you know, Yoruba and stuff. But I, you know, man, it was such an amazing experience, because in the rehearsals in the basement of his house there, you know, there were like 16 musicians, 16, you know, 15 African musicians and me. And every musician knew all the bass parts, all the bass, every, so whenever, and there were often these occasions where I make a mistake. 15 guys, ba da da ba. I go, oh, okay, right. You're going, da-do-da-da-ba, not da-boo-da-ba.
Unbelievable.
Everybody knew the stuff. I was like, wow. I've never been in a band where everybody knew. Well, I have since then, but I hadn't been in a band at that point where, you know, everybody knew all of everybody's
But how about individual sound? I mean, how early in your music did you say to yourself, or was it even a conscious thing, I don't want to sound, I mean, I like the way these guys sound, but I want my, I need my own. How do you go about creating the individual sound? It's so imperative because that's why I keep going after you, man.
You know, back in our day, that was what you did. You know, you wanted to listen to Charlie Parker and you wanted to understand what he was doing, but you didn't want to sound like Charlie Parker. You wanted to do something just as exciting. You wanted to be a master of your instrument like Charlie was, you know, and know it top to bottom. But you didn't just want to go be little do little be that a little do little. So, you know, and you know, before the whole mass communication thing happened in the digital world happened, bands were known for their sound. You know, bands, they had a sound. James Brown had a band, they had a sound. You know, the Four Tops had a sound. And so, you know, the great producers were putting together their signature sounds for, you know, like the Berry Gordys and all in that world on the music. So to be a part of something, it didn't help you to sound like somebody else because they'd get somebody else. Well, let's just go get him.
Individuality was key.
We were all
key.
Looking for our own sound.
Exactly.
Yeah. If this guy used a 5-star mouthpiece, you might try a 4, you know, because I don't want to sound like you. And when the guys were starting to go with the metal mouthpieces, you know, on my soprano, I don't want to play a metal mouthpiece. It's not the sound I want. You know, you sound like that guy. Guys like Wayne Shorter started, you know, doing songs like Naiba and whatnot, where they started going, well, you know, you can go in and you don't know exactly where you are. And the Herbie Hancock was so successful with Maiden Voyage, you know, it was just sus chords, but nobody was using sus chords. So anyway, we were inspired by those guys to improvise. And that's when I really first started improvising. And I find that you learn on the job, and you learn from almost any source rather than a teacher saying, okay, this is a dotted quarter note, and it sounds like this. There's music everywhere. Go out and see, you know, Cecil McBee, the Dave Holland play. You know, go catch Ron Carter play. Mm-hmm. Go see guys you've never heard of who are masterful in, you know, the town you're in. Go see them play. Anybody you like, you know, the Art Ensemble of Chicago, you know, just go see these guys play and learn from what you hear and what you see. So, and I did.
So this is the last story I want you to tell because it was such an epic story. The time when you walked in and met Sun Ra's band. The thing is, this goes back to the upright bass because you were running across the bridge. Yeah. Take us through walking in, meeting the guy. Take us through it.
I'm living in Oakland, and I go over to the old Waldorf to see. I bought a ticket to go see Sun Ra play because, you know, he doesn't come around that often, and I was going. So I got there. I didn't know anybody really except I had played for about a year or so with a guy named Eddie Gale, who's an outstanding trumpeter you know, that was living in the Hayward, California area, and we were doing some gigs around, and we went back to New York to the Village to play in Soho. We went to play in Soho at Rashid Ali's Ali's Alley. I forget the year, but I think it was 80. It was in 80. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, Eddie was good friends with John Gilmore, and they were buddies, and they played together a lot, you know. And some people saw me in New York and da-da-da and stuff. We come back out. So Sun Ra's coming out, and, you know, I got John Gilmore, my name in my head, right? John Gilmore. So I get there a little early, and the band is sitting there because the old Waldorf had a restaurant, you know, like a lot of clubs do. And it was a premier performance venue in San Francisco. And the band's sitting there eating before they go on, you know? And I walk in, and I know John Gilmore's face because I've seen him on records and I've seen him on TV. And so I go, hey, you know, my name's Amo. You know, I'm friends with Eddie Gale. You know, he said to say hi to you. I play bass with him. He said, you play bass with Eddie Gale? I said, yeah, you know, I play. He said, you play upright? I said, yeah, I play upright bass with Eddie Gale. He said, you want to play the gig? I mean, you know, so after I was resuscitated, yes. You know, actually.
They were willing to play the gig without a bass player, obviously. I mean, they
were going
to
go on without a bass player. I don't know what happened to the bass player. I never got to the point where I asked him. When he asked me if I wanted to play the gig, I looked at my watch, and I had to get across the bay, get the bass, put on my Sun Ra clothes, because he gave us a prescription of what the attire
skull
would be.
Cap, right?
Skull cap, don't show too much skin, and, you know, and get back here. And so, oh, man, I mean, I must have had Scotty and Captain Kirk on my side as I must have beamed over the bay, got the rig, you know, turned around, beamed back across the bay, and walked in as they were finishing. They did long numbers, but they were doing the last number of the first set. So I, you know, I stood back there, and he said, boom, he motions to me, like, come on up. You know, so I go up and tune the bass live on the stand. He puts me in this spot here. All the while, they're playing. You know, Michael Ray's doing yoga, taking his leg up straight in a vertical position while he's blowing notes. Circular breathing. I'm like, you know, doing the bass up. And he just says, points to me, play. I loved it. Play. You know, so I started playing. And, you know, they had a mic on me so I could hear it, what I was doing. Fine. Okay, here we are. We just played, did a solo or two and stuff, and the audience clapped and liked it. And after the show, he says, what are you doing tomorrow, you know? So I went off and did a tour with Sun Ra and, you know, played some stuff. And I had some commitments in the Bay Area, and I had to get back to them, but I did get the chance to do that. And, you know, man, I don't know where I was, probably like 2005 or so, when the internet sort of was full swing, somebody emails me and says, are you that Amo Chip that was something? I got a cassette tape of that. I'm like, he says, do you want it?
This is great.
Yeah. Of course, it was garbled, you know, and you couldn't really, but you could, you know, there was enough there, especially me, right? I'm like this kid's, you know, waiting for Christmas sitting there, and I was just leaning in, listening to it. Hear a little bass in there, so it's like pretty cool.
How do you get audiences to become engaged in the music of the Amosphere, being that there are lots of distractions today that didn't exist back in the game?
You know, the most stimulating thing that happens to most people on a regular basis is some new experience, whatever it is. You go to a new restaurant, you go to a new town, you meet a new person, something new, the newness being the active word here. And in music, you have to have the same newness. You know, so it's like the conversation came up, you know, let's make some set lists and have our show so we all know where we're going. And I'm thinking, you know, I can't do that, because what if nobody shows up? The set list you made for a crowd, what if everybody shows up and they want to dance, 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 and you've got four, you know, blues tunes? So, you know the material. It's like I was saying about being conversant. You know the material, so you can just call it like you see it. And I think one of the things people like about the Amosphere, is that we do that. We do it pretty well, because, you know, you can't get a delay a game penalty on you waiting. What if you let's huddle up? No, you know, the band leader or any of the members of the band, you know, can call out to me a tune that they think we should play right now for that audience, because it should be for that audience, so that it's new to everybody.
Did you ever get to a point in your career, or did you ever? I mean, I felt like even though I wasn't around, did you ever see Lee Morgan or Miles. In talking to enough of these, over 300 of these cats, they basically, there was a period in their early careers where they were just like, we're not really there to please the audience. We're there to keep honing our chops. And then they can, the audience can judge based on our playing, whether they like it or not.
Cats even wore suits to the gigs too, okay? You know, they took it very seriously. And then, you know, you can't say all that without you know, the begging question of the ethnicity and the race factor, because, you know, it's, and I use Jackie Robinson over and over in this sense, because, you know, he had to prove that he was just as good. You know, and the black musicians, especially to all those guys back east that we know from St. Louis to Buffalo, you know, in the Detroit, in Michigan and Chicago, you know, they had to prove their ability.
They actually had to do more. They had to prove, and then they
and
more.
Then, yeah. Right, because you had that stigmatism attached to you know, to the black musicians. So, you know, I think that's one of the reasons why they always wore suits. You know, if you showed up and you didn't, you know, you can't play the gig, man. So they also strove to be better than everybody else around them. You know, it's like, you know, I'm not good enough. I got to practice, you know. And so, you know, and then a guy comes along like, you know, Sidney Bechet, or a guy comes along like what's our guy's name? John Coltrane, mm-hmm. You know, or a guy comes along like a Victor Wooten, and they change the game, or a Future Man, they change the game, you know. And so cats, you know, first time I heard Victor Wooten, the second thing I did was go practice. First thing I did was curse myself out for not having practiced before. It's like, man, oh my God, I, you know, harmonics all over the bass. Okay, let's go.
It just made my Monday.